Horror Movie Fans. I'm your host, Ryan Denlevy. That's my co-host, Rob Dunham.
We're back.
Yes, after...
We're rested and yes. Not sick.
Not sick, not insanely busy, yes.
Apologies to everyone for the missed week, but sometimes life.
Yes, sometimes life. And, you know, despite the millions of dollars we get paid to do this podcast, you know, sometimes we just can't make it happen. So, but we are back and it's going to be a great show for you. We will, of course, give you a great update on the box office. We'll tell you what's coming out this week. We will cover a few news stories with The Matrix and James Earl Jones, and we'll have a discussion on the most unique sci-fi film premises, which should be a fun one. And we'll conclude with our watch list. All right, Rob, are you ready?
I've been waiting for a fortnight.
Yes.
To talk about movies. So.
Yes, indeed. All right, so let's jump in straight into the box office. Good week for the box office this past weekend. The box office overall was up 108% from previous weekend, largely due to the arrival of Beetlejuice. We did not get a chance to preview that one last week as we were off. However, it did fantastically well at the box office, which we did comment that we suspected it would do. It would do pretty good. And it did. It did $111 million in its opening weekend. Really, really fantastic opening. It was in 4,575 theaters. So it was basically everywhere.
Yeah.
If you had a movie theater, you were showing Beetlejuice.
I mean, I know at the Regal in York opening weekend, there were probably like 15 to 20 shows every day.
Yeah.
Of the movie. Like every 15 minutes, there was a showing of it.
Yeah, they really leaned into that one for sure. And it was the same up here in this region. It was just Beetlejuice. We talked about 2 weeks ago how there were just all these, like six or seven movies came out. Vast majority of them were one and done. Mm-hmm. they were also a lot of smaller films, but they were all one and done. Like none of them stayed in the box office. Yeah. Everyone just cleared everything out for Beetlejuice. But yeah, really, really well. Number two was Deadpool and Wolverine. 7 weeks in, it's still number two in the box office. It did $7 million, $613 million domestically. Oh, man, that's still rocking. Surprise number three, after being a surprise the previous week, number three was Reagan. It moved up one spot. It did $4.8 million. It actually had added 16 theaters this past week, and it's a total of $18.1 million. So solid numbers for like a somewhat indie, not really promoted biopic.
Yeah.
So
pretty shabby.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Alien Romulus finished number four in week four. It did $3.9 million. It is at $97 million. So it probably gets to the $100 million mark. Mm-hmm. And number five closed out with It Ends With Us. Did $3.7 million in its fifth week in the box office. $141 million for It Ends With Us. It's a remarkable showing for a movie like that. Yeah. I definitely didn't see that coming.
No.
I don't really know why, but people were excited about it and really have come out to see it.
Just in general, when it comes to the box office, it seems that the last few months, for whatever reason, we've been seeing a lot of movies that people are interested in seeing. And I don't know if that's because studios are actually listening to what people want to see. Because it seems like movies are coming out that people are actually excited about and invested in, which has not been the case the last few years.
It is not.
And I think, obviously, Beetlejuice out now.
Mm-hmm.
Speak No Evil has already got a lot of good buzz around it. It's made $5 million its opening day.
Yes, which we'll get to in a second. Well.
And I think Joker, Fully Ado, is going to make
money too. I think so. Yeah.
I think that's probably My prediction for Joker Folie à Deux is it's going to challenge like R-rated movie records. I think it is. I think with Joaquin Phoenix and Lady Gaga combined and how well the first one did, I think it could be pretty big.
It's interesting. I mean, you're looking straight at Deadpool and Wolverine
mm-hmm.
for the R-rated records. Yeah. I don't think it's going to go that high. I do think it's going to be very successful.
Yeah.
I just think the dark nature of this version of the Joker, I think, will have a limit to the amount of people, as opposed to the fun entertainment version of Deadpool and Wolverine. I think there will be a limit. That said, I think it will be very, very successful.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see what kind of audience Lady Gaga being in it draws. Because I think it has potential to draw a wider audience because of that.
Yeah. Although, I mean, she's had other successful films.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing that like super broke the box office. But she's had other successful
Star films. Star is Born was
yes.
really good.
Yeah, that'd be her primary success for sure. All right. Anything else on the box office results?
Beetlejuice owns box office.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm guessing it's going to end up at number one again this weekend, too. So, all right. So let's move on to what comes out this week. And we have really, there's another five movies. Now, some of them are a little bit more of an indie nature. But probably the primary release is Speak No Evil. Rated R, hour and 50 minutes. And it's a family gets invited to spend a whole weekend in a lovely home in the countryside. As the weekend progresses, they'll soon realize that the family who's inviting them has a dark side laying inside them.
Mm.
James McAvoy and Mackenzie Davis are the two biggest names in this one. Next up, Am I Racist? PG-13, 141. A man investigates diversity, equity, inclusion practices, exposing absurdities through undercover social experiments. This is a Matt Walsh film, and he is the main star. The Critic, rated R, 1 hour, 41 minutes as well. A powerful London theater critic becomes entangled in a web of deceit and murder. Ian McKellen and Gemma Arterton are in this one. And The Killer's Game, rated R, 1 hour, 44 minutes. A veteran assassin is diagnosed with a life-threatening illness and authorizes a kill on himself. After ordering the kill, an army of former colleagues pounce and a new piece of information comes to light. Insanity ensues.
Oh.
Oh. Dave Bautista, Sophie Boutelet, Pom Clementif in this one. The 4:30 movie, rated R, 1 hour and 27 minutes. A group of teens in the 1980s spends a day theater hopping. A coming-of-age story from Kevin Smith. So some of them are more indie releases, but a number of different ones. Rob, what do you make of it?
So I would say to varying degrees, I'm interested in all of them.
Yeah.
I know you're probably more interested in the Matt Walsh movie than I am. Mm-hmm. That'd probably be like the lowest on my list. And that's not really because of him at all. It's I'm not in general, not really a huge fan of let's act like something we're not to make other people look stupid and record them looking stupid.
Yeah.
Now, granted, they're choosing to say everything they're saying on their own. Like they're not being forced to say it.
Yes.
But I've never really been a huge fan of that.
There are
style.
like Borat did this most famously.
Yeah.
And Borat's a whole nother level.
Yeah.
But
This will not be like Borat. I'm sure it will be funny. Yeah. It'll probably be more depressing than funny and analysis of things. But The Killer's Game, I think I thought that looked really cool.
Yeah.
From what I've seen, like early reporting on it, it's not gonna do super well in the box office. I'm not necessarily surprised by that.
Yeah.
But I Dave Bautista, I think, is an underrated actor. Mm-hmm. I've really liked seeing him do different kinds of roles coming out of the wrestling world. You could argue that he's the best wrestler turned actor, I think. Obviously The Rock would have something to say about that. But I think Dave Bautista might be a better actor.
I would guess Dave Bautista is a better actor. I mean, obviously The Rock is a star.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of acting chops, yeah. Dave Bautista may have it. He's done a lot more dramatic roles to greater success.
And I'm very, very excited about Speak No Evil. This is probably the scary movie I've been looking forward to the most all year.
Yeah, this is an interesting one because this is the brand of kind of horror scary-ish that I am not opposed to seeing necessarily. So there is a level to which I'm interested in each of them.
And James McAvoy, in my opinion, is a fantastic actor. Like, he is top quality.
Mm-hmm.
And just based on what I've seen from the trailers, he looks like he's going to have a phenomenal.
He has a great creepy side.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've seen now, I know Glass was the second Split is the one. Yeah. So he was unbelievably creepy in Split.
Yeah.
So he's going to channel some of that.
What was the creepiest thing about that was how much she was able to be a chameleon and easily transform from person to person to person. And there are certain actors, we've talked about this, who they blend into things because they change their appearance or they change their accent. And then I would put James McAvoy in the category of like Tom Hanks.
Mm.
Or I guess Matt Damon could fall in this category too. Like guys who don't really necessarily change how they talk or change their appearance, but they still get into their character so much that you're able to see the difference between the characters they play.
Yeah. Yeah. And Mackenzie Davis is underrated, I think, too. She usually stands out. She doesn't star in a lot of movies, but she's usually a side actor and usually stands out in the role. I just recently watched The Martian again. She was great as one of the Capcom people in that one. She had a small role in Blade Runner 2049. It was good. Every time I've seen her, she's been good. So I think moving into a more of a leading role on this one, I think will suit her. I will definitely go see I Am a Racist. I probably will go see The Killer's Game too, because it looks like just a fun action movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it says insanity ensues. I mean,
How
can you not? The Critic actually seems pretty interesting to me. Mm-hmm. I'm going to look into that a little bit more. Obviously, Ian McKellen's fantastic. Yeah. And Gemma Arterton's a pretty good actor, too. And this has an interesting premise. I'm curious as to where they go with it. I'm going to look into that a little bit more, too. I mean, I would love to go to the theaters like four or five times. So probably won't get to all
of these. The 4:30 movie, too. Kevin Smith. I like a lot of what he does, just thought-wise and direction-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see this being like a carryover from like Clerks, Mallrats, just kind of that vibe. And I enjoy those movies.
It seems from looking it up that it looks like it really is kind of a nostalgia piece to 80s cinema.
Yeah.
Of like being Kevin Smith being a teenager, the experience of going to the movies with your friends as teenagers seems like a lot of what this movie has to offer. So there's definitely some
Is definitely a weekend where I would be tempted to do a trip, double or triple feature at the theater if I could find a way to carve out the time.
I know, right? Yeah, that'd be pretty cool. Any other thoughts on those?
I think we can hit all of them. So
yeah, okay. A couple other news items coming up this next weekend, the 19th and the 22nd specifically. The Matrix comes back into theaters for its 25th anniversary. Came out in 1999. And there's a 2 days where it will be back in theaters. It's going to have a pretty wide release, so it probably will be in one of the theaters near you.
How can a movie be having its 25th anniversary when it's like 5 years old?
I know, right? Yeah. I really want to find a way to go see this because... Yeah. I did not see the original when it was out in theaters in 1999. I didn't see it till it came out on video. So I was late to the Matrix train.
Yeah.
Of course, I saw the rest of them in theaters, but I did not see this originally in theater. So I think it would be awesome to be able to see it for the first time in theater.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
I agree.
Yeah. But check that out. It's this, I think, Friday and then Sunday or Monday or Thursday and Sunday. Mm-hmm. One of those two. I don't have my other phone on me. Tell what calendar is. September 19th and September 22nd. It will be in theaters. And so
today make sure. Today is the 13th, so that would be Friday and Monday.
Friday and Monday.
Yeah.
Yep. So this coming Friday and the following Monday here, you can find The Matrix in theaters. So that's going to be cool. That should be a fun experience. And I think it will probably do pretty well for an anniversary release. Next up, we have a sad note, but a popular actor, James Earl Jones, died in the last, I think, week and a half. It was about a week and a half ago. James Earl Jones died at the age of 93. James Earl Jones, obviously legendary actor, legendary voice, presence, all those type of things. And he finally moved on.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the movie world has been spending the last week or two celebrating James Earl Jones, talking about his accomplishments, his indelible influence on movies and a movie history through some of his more iconic roles. So I thought we'd spend just a minute or two talking about our favorite James Earl Jones roles and our experience with James mm-hmm. Earl Jones in films.
Well, for me, I mean, it starts and ends with Field of Dreams.
Mm.
If you build it, they will come.
Yeah.
They will most certainly come.
One of the greatest monologues of all time.
The best monologue in a sports movie ever.
Yeah.
And probably one of the best period ever.
It is.
And I will say my one brother replied to that comment with, "That's not even his best role in the baseball movies." Which I said was heresy.
I agree.
Yeah, it's the same lot, but
it's not in the same category. No, sorry.
I mean, there's one other massive one that I'm sure you could talk about,
uh-huh.
the role that he played.
Obviously, I don't know. Would you say he is most known for this?
Probably.
I would say probably. He was famously the voice of Darth Vader in the Star Wars films. Mm-hmm. He was not the actor in the suit. He was the voice. Also famously, David Prowse played Darth mm-hmm. Vader, the actor, and then they dubbed over James Earl Jones's voice to fantastic effect.
Mm-hmm.
Prowse is still not happy about that.
Yeah.
And still claims that it was, you know, like a diversity thing. It's like, do you know James Earl Jones is just significantly better than you.
Yeah,
yeah. Sorry. No, yeah. James Earl Jones is better than you.
Yeah.
But you know, obviously one of the most legendary characters in cinema history, one of the most legendary bad guys, and it doesn't work without James Earl Jones' voice.
Yeah.
Like that iconic voice, Luke.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can hear it in your head. You are part of the Rebel Alliance and a traitor. You know, all of that. I mean, so many good things. I mean, that his voice just lends gravitas and presence to that role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, voice of Mufasa too.
Yes. Voice of Mufasa. I mean,
there's a lot he's done.
Yeah. I loved him also in the Jack Ryan films mm-hmm. in the early 90s. He played Greer in all three of those movies.
It's going to be very interesting too, as I was reading an article about James Earl Jones is one of the first actors who they have recorded and digitized enough of his voice that his voice is going to be used in mm-hmm. future work as an AI voice.
And he has given express permission to allow, like in particular Star Wars, mm-hmm. to be able to use his voice.
So that's going to be really interesting to see how that goes, because I've read in articles that some voice actors are like really like excited about that. And some are like very wary of it.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see. He'll be one of the first like super famous actors who's going to be mm-hmm. a test case for this, you know, new technology. So
yeah. Any other roles that stick out to you for James Earl Jones?
I mean, I nailed all the big ones, I think.
Yeah. He's an interesting actor because he's very famous, but he didn't always have to be like in a leading role.
Mm-hmm.
He exists in a lot of movies as not a side character, but as in one of the supplementary actors in a particular film. And he was always good in that role.
Mm-hmm.
So James Earl Jones will be missed. Can hear him. I just picture him, you know, the chuckling as he enters the cornfield and slowly disappears. Yeah. Like that's just a great image to leave with for James Earl Jones.
I'd like to make one point of correction. The 19th and 22nd is Thursday and Sunday.
Okay. I figured like You got to get one weekday in there. Yeah. Okay. Thursday and Sunday for The Matrix. Yeah. All right. So that's our news items. And let's move on to our discussion. So today we're going to be talking about unique sci-fi premises. One of the cool things about science fiction movies that are, especially the ones that are done well, is they pose kind of an intellectual idea, and then the film explores what that idea would look like given a particular set of circumstances. So it gives sci-fi the opportunity to really explore both the human condition and technology, innovation, how humans would interact in certain circumstances. It's a really unique genre and can be really, really fun when done well. And it's been done well many, many times. And so we thought we would talk a bit about a few of our favorite sci-fi movies that have unique premises. So obviously unique premises is different, that is not the same thing as a sci-fi movie that we love. Yeah. Like, we're talking about the actual, like, underlying story elements, the thing that drives the story, that kind of underlining narrative that the film is trying to get at. So Rob, why don't you pick one and go first?
So I'm gonna say one that some people might argue is not even a sci-fi movie, because for some reason when we think of sci-fi, we think of space.
That's not always the case. Sometimes the premise actually makes it a sci-fi.
Well, what you described, I think the movie I'm thinking of is the perfect example of it. And I think that some people might also discount it because it's become such a part of popular culture that they don't think about the depth of the actual story, which is incredibly detailed and deep.
Okay, now I'm curious as to what this movie is.
Let's absolutely laser focused on the hubris of man. Jurassic Park.
Oh yeah, no, I think that counts absolutely,
because Jurassic Park is entirely science fiction. Because it's based on the idea of developing and growing and releasing dinosaurs into our actual world, which, in order to take place, obviously you have to have an underpinning of a massive amount of research and science and development. And in addition to that, it explores what happens when they get loose, or someone in the group of the humans gets too greedy or too lazy. When I say Jurassic Park, I'm going to include like all of the movies as one here, because they all explore different areas of these themes.
The first one, though, definitely uniquely did it, because it really did hone in on the idea of what happens if science goes too far. Is it possible for science to go too far? Especially exploring the Malcolm character in that film does a great job of that.
And I mean, the caretaker, you know, just was completely passionate about building this world, about bringing this back for kids and families to see. And obviously money was an incentive, but it wasn't his driving motivation.
Yeah.
But you have the motivation of the banking side, the lawyer, you have the motivation of the statistical analyst, you have the motivation of the geologist, who's just like, oh man, this is so cool.
Yeah.
And that's my favorite part of it, is that you've got three or four competing views of, we've done this, now what do we do with it, all coming together. And I think especially, like you said, the first Jurassic Park is written in a phenomenal way to explore each of those different views and then bring them together so that they collide.
Yeah.
And then you have, as we said, insanity ensuing. That would be what happens in Jurassic Park for sure. Yeah. And you see it carry over into Lost World and Jurassic Park 3 and the new ones too. But I do think the first one, firstly, because it is the first one.
Yeah.
So you're the most unique premise of any of them is the first one, because it did not exist in a movie form. Obviously, it came from the book.
Yeah.
But I think it's a lot deeper than people really think or understand, because it's become such a popular franchise.
Yeah, and it has such a great, like, there's, I'm thinking of a couple conversations in particular. There's the one where they're eating lunch and they're talking about, and instead of them, after seeing some of this stuff, instead of being like super excited, all on board, they're all a little skeptical, and they all have different reasons why they're all a little skeptical. And then later in the film, they're sitting around Richard Attenborough's character and the woman are sitting there eating ice cream. And, you know, he's talking about the flea circus and how he wanted to give people something real. Like, that's a converse. Mm-hmm. That's a great conversation about, you know, what is real and versus what is illusion. What do you think you can control versus what you can't control? And it really is. It's a fascinating discussion, because that is one of the key things about science is, you know, is it possible for science to go too far? If what happens, like, what's the right criteria for putting a lid on science? And that is a key area of exploration. That's
I think the best part about sci-fi, which we'll just briefly mention on this one,
yeah.
But I think any of the movies we talk about, sci-fi is so effective because it reflects something about ourselves,
yes,
typically that we don't like.
Mm-hmm. Or at least it needs to be explored, mm-hmm, or talked about in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you?
First one up on my list is Minority Report. Minority Report, based on a Philip K. Dick short story. Awesome movie, 2002, Tom Cruise. And it explores the idea of what they call pre-crime. Like, if you could see the future and you knew that somebody was going to commit a crime, in the movie, they have a whole division that goes and arrests those people and puts them basically in, you know, cyber, you know, I'm blanking out on the right terms, like cyber jail, mm-hmm, where they're just kind of in a pod and their mind is kind of in some sort of stasis type thing. So it's basically the idea of exploring the topic of the future, exploring the idea of how can you judge someone for something they haven't done if you know they will do it? And that comes to precognition. There's one fantastic scene when they're trying to explain what pre-crime is, and the guy rolls a ball across the table and the other guy catches it. So why do you catch it? Because it was going to fall, but didn't fall. You prevented it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but that didn't change the fact that you were going to do it,
right,
that it was going to happen, is you're going to do it. And so that's kind of their logic behind the pre-crime. So it explores that idea of free will versus determinism. And if you saw the future and you saw what specific is, do we have the option to change that? And is it, how much can we judge people based on those type of things? So it really does lean into the predestination versus free will versus choice and that sort of stuff heavily. It's a really interesting
And point. We've seen some of this reflected in the real world. And first of all, the emergence of AI and predictive technology.
Yes.
But also, I mean, I don't know if you just want to call it investigation, but mm-hmm, we've seen things stop before they happen.
Yeah.
Most recently, the big thing I'm thinking about is the terrorist attack that was
for the Taylor Swift concerts. Yeah.
Because they had months of tracking and, mm-hmm, planning and studying to see that these people were planning this.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, a movie like Minority Report makes me wonder, like, where's the trigger point?
Yeah.
Like, where do you say, all right, this has crossed the line where if we don't act, yeah, something bad is going to happen.
Well, and it's one of those things where one of the discussion points about this is murder basically ceased. Like, the movie, mm-hmm, takes place in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. currently is one of the biggest murder areas in the country. And basically in the movie, this pre-crime has basically wiped out murder.
Mm-hmm.
And all it took was arresting people who technically had not yet committed any crimes. So at what point do you do that?
Yeah, because the main phrase that is used in Minority Report is thought crime.
Yeah.
Because it is the pre-plan, the precognition.
Yeah, they see what you are planning to do in your mind, mm-hmm, and they're, quote, never wrong.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, we've even seen some of this in with some of the proactive policing type things where we've had to have some of these discussions. Like, they've used computer predictive technology to say where particular crime hotspots might be, and then they flood that area with police. And then the question is like, okay, is it okay to be a little more proactive to frisk people who are looking suspicious if we haven't technically committed any crime, but we know that area is flooded with crime. It's really fascinating.
It is. And just to provide another analogy, I know not everyone who listens to the podcast are sports fans, but I was fascinated. I was watching Thursday Night Football on Amazon, and they actually have a technology now where they can see how the defense is set up, and they actually put a little red circle under people they think are going to blitz on a play. Mm. And when I was watching this game, like 90% of the time they put a circle under someone that came.
Interesting.
And so if a computer is able to like figure something like that out, where are we headed?
Yeah.
You know, because what exactly are we going to be able to prevent?
And one thing in particular for people with disabilities, they're prototyping some heads up displays on football helmets for some of that stuff. So if you could end up in a world where you had some heads up displays with AI technology helping a quarterback read defenses, it would be fascinating. I think ultimately they'll step in and say, no, we're not going to do that. But that's the type of discussions you have to have. At what point has this crossed the line? Which is a big thing that sci-fi is a great job at exploring.
Next one for me is Starship Troopers.
Ah, okay.
And I like this one. The uniqueness I find of the premise in this is it's kind of exploring the final working out of the military industrial complex to its ultimate aim, which is to protect and dominate everything. And it really plays on the idea of xenophobia is a big thing in this one, being afraid of things that aren't you.
Yeah.
Because they're big, scary insects, you know. It does turn out they're like not all evil, but they could be. So we get rid of them. And one of the phrases in the movie is, I'm doing my part. And every time it's kind of funny. Every time I see like a military commercial now, I always think of Starship Troopers. by the way, I know he's not going to hear this, but someone who knows him might hear this. So shout out to my brother, Jason, who actually is in basic training for the Army right now.
Oh, wow.
He left last week.
Oh, wow. Okay. So he's probably dying right now.
Yeah, big step for him. He's in Georgia. He's probably wishing he was not in Georgia.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I have a lot of respect for the military. We have a history of that in my family, both my grandfathers. Mm-hmm. One was in the Navy, one was in the Marines. My brother is the first one since them to join the military. I always have a little hesitation or fear of military overstepping its bounds. Mm-hmm. And that's why I like Starship Troopers, because I think it shows what can happen when that does happen. And also shows the juxtaposition of people who are aligned with the scientific community, people who are aligned with the arts community, who are aligned with the military industrial complex, and them all coming together, much like Jurassic Park, like all coming together and what wins, you know, and what is the motivation for who is winning and what is their aim? Why are they trying to win? And the movie is very funny. It's very inappropriate. So it's not a kid's movie at all, but if you're an adult who can handle like some themes and some really weird stuff, then Starship Troopers might be something that you would enjoy. Have you ever seen the movie?
I don't think I have, to be honest with you. I don't think I have.
Neil Patrick Harris actually has a great one in that movie.
It's one of those where I've been familiar with it forever, and just I didn't see it when it originally came out, and I've just never got it around.
Does a really good job of playing off like the archetypes and stereotypes of sci-fi, like the guy who wants to be in charge, you know, and the guy who's a little shy, and the girl who's just trying to get ahead, like all these different things that we see throughout a lot of different movies. It's in a lot of ways, it's a parody of science fiction, but I think it does a good job of actually being science fiction itself.
Nice. The next one I'm going to go with is Children of Men. And Children of Men is another one of those sci-fi movies that doesn't necessarily seem sci-fi because it doesn't have, it's not highly futuristic. It does take place in the future, but not highly futuristic. It's not space driven, any of those type of things, but it is a sci-fi movie because it explores a really fascinating premise. And we've talked about it before on the podcast, but the premise of the movie is that for whatever reason, and nobody knows why in the movie, women stop being able to have children. And so at this point where the movie starts, the youngest person in the world is 16 years old. So it takes this idea of what happens if you no longer have the next generation. What happens if you can no longer have children? What happens to society? What happens to individuals? How does everything cope with this? And so it's a fascinating exploration of take a premise and then build out a world based on that premise. And it really, I think it has a unique take on what a world in which there are no more children and there is no, it takes the kind of the idea of what is our hope for the future and says, okay, when we can't have kids, then we cease to have a vision beyond our lives. We cease to have a future beyond our lives. And then explores the ideas of depression, isolation, kind of nihilism, like a heavy dose of nihilism. And then it, in the middle of all this bleakness, it injects a ray of hope, but then watches as the world around it tries to destroy that. And so it's really, really fascinating. It's such a unique and interesting premise about taking a premise and then building an entire world around the exploration of that idea of what happens if there's no more kids.
I mean, we have there's a whole subgenre of post-apocalyptic movies that this one is unique in that space because it's not built around deserted desert wasteland, but it's built around the wasteland of no more kids.
Yeah.
Which is its own wasteland. And probably, I think it's scarier than a lot of the movies like Mad Max or Book of Eli or something like that, where you're just fighting the elements a lot.
Yeah, because it feels like it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like it's something that's possible. And I mean, and one of the things to think about this, I mean, obviously not to this level, but as we look at one of the things that's happening, especially in Western societies, is the birth rate has collapsed. Like most Western countries are below replacement level for birth rate. And so when you increasingly have a society that has fewer and fewer kids, you start to see that affect the nature of society. And that's basically what the exploration of this is. If you have no longer a society that's focused on raising the next generation, what happens?
Mm-hmm.
And, in the film, nothing good.
Yeah.
Nothing good happens. And it's really fascinating.
Yeah, a lot of it ends up revolving around protecting what's yours and at all costs. Yeah. Because what else do you have?
Mm-hmm. Or just flat out giving up.
Mm-hmm.
Flat out giving up. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My last one I'll say is actually something I watched last night. So I'll very briefly say that I watched it in the watch list.
Okay.
Flight of the Navigator.
Hmm.
It's a Disney movie from 1986.
Okay.
And have you seen Flight of the Navigator?
Don't think so.
Okay. So it's a kid. He's 8 years old.
Okay.
He's 12 years old. And he's chasing his brother through the woods. And his dog sees something down a ravine. And he looks down the ravine and he falls in the ravine and gets knocked unconscious. And when he wakes up, it's 8 years in the future.
Mm.
And no one can explain what happened. And simultaneously, there is a spaceship that gets found in caught in an electrical grid. It ran into a couple electrical towers. And NASA takes the spaceship, and the police find this boy, and they're like, they figure out there might be a connection here somehow.
Hmm.
And they end up hooking the boy up to this machine that's like studying his brainwaves. And they ask him questions, and he's answering the questions through his brainwaves. It's like typing out on the screen. And all of a sudden, all this alien language comes up on the screen. And he's like, who's doing that? And they say, it's you, David. It's coming from you.
Interesting.
And so he basically has what happened was the alien entity had been going around to all different places, gathering up specimens to take back and analyze in their home planet. And they realized that humans only use 10% of their brains. So they kidnapped a kid and filled the rest of his brain with star charts. And then when the alien ship crashed, he didn't have access to his star charts anymore. So he has to get the kid back so he can access the charts so he knows how to get home.
Oh, interesting.
And the whole time he's saying, I can't take you back to your time. It'd be too dangerous. So you're just going to have to be like this. And I won't give away what happens. But one of the really funny things about this is the voice of the navigator is a person called Paul Mall, who is also known as Paul Rubens, a.k.a. Pee Wee Herman.
Interesting.
And you can't tell it's him for the first half of the movie because he talks in a low voice. Interesting. But then like about halfway through the movie, he laughs at one point. He does a ho-ho laugh, the Pee Wee Herman laugh. And you're like, oh, okay, that's him. But it's a really good, wholesome movie. Actually, it has Sarah Jessica Parker in it, too. Okay. It's like, she must have been in her early 20s. It's 1986. The unique thing that I love about it is it really does a good job of exploring science fiction from a kid's perspective,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of it is viewed through the lens of the 12-year-old kid who's like, this is insane.
Yeah.
Like, I have no idea what's happening. Mm-hmm. Why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? And the navigator himself is just really funny. And the whole movie is funny. More people should watch it. It's on Disney Plus. If you have Disney Plus, I would recommend checking out Flight of the Navigator.
Nice. The last one, I would be remiss if I didn't bring up Inception. there's plenty more to talk about, but I have to go to Inception. Christopher Nolan's unbelievably unique take on dreams, and not just exploring dreams and the role that dreams can play in your life, basically, in the film, which I don't know why you haven't seen it if you haven't seen it, but you know, just to quickly recap, they've figured out how to share dreams and then explore the dream space. And sometimes they can use that for training purposes. Sometimes they can use that, in this case, to heist something from someone else's mind, or as Inception indicates, to place something into somebody else's mind through dreams. And it's a fully realized concept with multiple levels. You have dreams within dreams within dreams, and rules that apply all through each one of those levels of dreams. But more so even than the role that dreams play, which always is like, it's an out there amorphous mm-hmm. thing that we never quite understand the role of what dreams play in our lives. And this kind of gives you some concrete ways to explore dreams in new and unique ways, but also comes back fundamentally to the idea of reality. What is real? What is not real? And the concept of like, if something can be so close to being real that it almost seems real, does that count? Or is there an objective reality? Is there one reality to live out? And explores that idea of what is real. It's especially explored through the character of Leonardo DiCaprio's character and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
It's really explored through that, because she wants to keep him in his memory of her, wants to keep him in those dreams to be with her. And he has to navigate, is this real? Is this not real? Can I be with her in a dream or can I not? And just such an in-depth exploration on such a unique and interesting topic.
Yeah, other movies along the line, like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, The Truman Show, movies that mm-hmm. when it's over, they alter something in your thought process to like,
yeah,
why did I just think that?
Mm-hmm.
Or why am I feeling this way?
Yeah.
Or is someone watching me? Am I on TV? Inception, I love the progression of the movie, how they present the concept and then flesh it out. Just
mm-hmm.
It's a movie that you have to pay attention to. Which is not necessarily for everybody, I think, because the movie involves heavy exposition almost the entire mm-hmm. way through, because they're always telling you something new.
Yeah.
And I like that style of movie, and I mm-hmm. like the reveal of what's happening at the beginning of the movie later on in the movie. And when I first saw it, when that happened, I was like, Wow.
You literally have no way of understanding the first 10 minutes of the movie the first time you watch it. It's just like, oh man, a lot of stuff's happening. What's going on? Yeah. A lot of stuff. Crazy. Oh my goodness.
And then when it clicks and the one character is saying something that you had heard him say earlier in the movie, it's just like, oh wow, we are, like, you realize where you are. And that's the beauty of the movie, is that there's five or six different worlds built into one movie, but all involving the same people.
Yeah. It's really, really fascinating. Eternal Sunshine was another one on my list. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Really great. But that's been fun. I could do this forever because there's so many good sci-fi premises. Maybe we'll revisit it for later. But we'll conclude today with our watch list, movies we've watched over the last week or so. 2 weeks, I guess, we'll put it, if you want to.
So I watched Beetlejuice twice.
Okay.
And I'm going to watch it again.
All right.
Believe it or not, I'd actually not seen the first Beetlejuice until like a month ago.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen Beetlejuice.
Okay. You should see Beetlejuice, and you should see the new one too.
Okay. All right.
Because Michael Keaton is, I've come to understand Michael Keaton is a very good actor. he was by far the best part of The Flash that came out the other year.
Oh yeah, totally.
He is a really good, really good character actor, and he is fantastic in this role as Beetlejuice, the trickster demon, who is trying to convince someone to basically bring him into the real world, is the entire goal that he's going for in the first and second movies. He actually has a bigger role in this second movie, which I like quite a bit because his character is really funny, really dark, really irreverent. The movie itself is pretty dark, but it's also hilarious. I mean, Willem Dafoe plays a guy who's in the afterlife because he was an actor playing a cop and half his head got blown off, like inside of his head got blown off by a grenade, live grenade on set, and that's why he died. Okay. In the afterlife, he thinks he's an actual cop, even though he's an actor playing a cop. And at one point, he's giving a speech to all the policemen, and they zoom out, and you see there's a lady behind all of them actually holding up cue cards that he's reading. But, yeah, Michael Keaton is fantastic. The whole cast is incredible. Just one example of the kind of wit in the movie. They're at a funeral, and the priest there is giving this, like, beautiful, moving, like, message to the mom, and he's like, oh, he'll be passing over Jordan into the fields of Elysium, blah, 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 blah. And he goes through this whole beautiful thing, and she just looks at him, and she goes, what? it does a great job of poking at concepts of eternity and fate and, you know, what is, what's real, what's not real. And really funny throughout, has some really good 80s music in there, which I'm always a big fan of. Hits a lot of the same notes as the first one. So if you've seen the first one, you will like the second one. And like I said, I like the second one more than the first one, which might be considered heresy. But also last night, I saw a movie that I had. I saw Flight of the Navigator last night, which I already mentioned. But I also saw a movie last night that I had not seen yet that was on my list to see for a long time. Us. By Jordan Peele. Have you seen that?
I've not seen Us.
Okay. I think this would be much more in the line of the kind of scary movie you like. Because it is very much about the human condition and a dark thriller more than it is a horror movie. Okay. It's not like a lot of blood and guts and supernatural or scary things. It's basically what would happen if there was a world existing within our world where there were copies of us, but like twisted, broken copies of us that aren't quite whole because they are forced to live below the earth. They're forced to live somewhere where they don't have access to everything that makes us fully who we are. And what if they came out and wanted to take our place? And basically that's what the whole movie is.
Interesting.
And it's pretty scary. I like Jordan Peele a lot. I think he's got a really interesting mind when it comes to horror and thriller stuff. So I would check that out. Us. Lupita Nyong'o, his main character, Winston Duke, is also a main character, and those two people are pretty good actors.
Okay. Sweet. I saw a couple of movies, couple I've watched with my wife over the last couple of weeks. Anyone But You, the Glenn Powell, Sydney Sweeney rom-com that came out at the end of last year.
Did quite well.
Yeah. Interesting movie. Probably had far more language than is necessary in a rom-com, but it was engaging. It was fun. It was interesting. The two characters obviously had fun making the film. It's set in Australia, so you get some great, like, you can get some great scenes and like some of the cool Sydney Australia type settings. You know, so yeah, it was decent. And then another one that she picked from Netflix, Happiness for Beginners, and it was fine. It was basically like a woman like breaks up with her husband, I think. Husband or fiance, and they're no longer together, and she wants to go on this like discovery journey. Mm-hmm. And so she signs up for this like 5-day camping adventure type thing, and her and all the people with her end up like, you know, learning something about themselves, and her brother's best friend goes along because he secretly had a crush on her the whole time. So as it, you know, hits very much of those. It's fine. It is perfectly reasonable Netflix film to watch with your spouse.
I'm waiting for Advanced Happiness.
Yeah. So yeah, I watched The Martian as well. I've talked about that a number of times, so I need to dig into it. It's just a great movie.
I need to watch it again.
Yeah, it's a great movie. I love the soundtrack to it. It's a very good soundtrack, and it's a really fun one to work to. Like when I'm doing work that I can't listen to words with lyrics, music with lyrics. So I spent this week writing, and I had that soundtrack on.
Nice.
A lot. Because it has a little bit of the electronic sci-fi elements, but it has a lot of like thoughtful out there tones. Like it has a space feel to it, but it feels more reflective.
Pensive space music.
Yeah.
Pensive space music for your local space pirate.
Yes. Well, that is the show, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to Film for Fans. Make sure you visit filmforfans.com and tell all your friends about the podcast. If you have any movies that are sci-fi that have unique premises that are your favorites, let us know. And until next time, enjoy the movies.